Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Several women have now run for their party's nomination for president. Two, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, got it, but neither achieved the White House. Since other nations have successfully been led by women, it makes you wonder why it hasn't happened here, but surely it is inevitable. Women make up 51% of the population, yet represent only 30% of the membership of the North Carolina legislature. In some southern states, women make up as little as 11% of those bodies. Progress has been uneven. For instance, in this last election, 13 states saw losses in female representation, including South Carolina. There, the three female Republican state senators who fought for reproductive rights were ousted in their primaries. But on the other side of the country, this last election means that women will make up a majority of state legislators in Colorado and New Mexico next year, joining Nevada, which became the first state to claim that distinction in 2019. What does all this mean for the future of women in politics and female leadership in the United States? Where are they making headway? Where have they lost ground? What does it take for women to win elections? And what does it mean for us when they do? Kelly Dittmar is Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers Camden and Director of Research at the Center for American Women in Politics, which is nationally recognized for the data it produces about women in politics. She is here along with Erin Los Cutraro, founder and CEO of She Should Run, a nonpartisan group working to increase the number of women running for office. And Brad Young is here. He's executive director of the North Carolina Institute of Political Leadership, also nonpartisan. It provides training programs to prepare individuals to enter politics and run for office. Good morning to everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. We welcome you.
Good morning.
It's radio. You got to talk. Kelly, I'm going to start with you. I know you have cold, hard data concerning elections and women in elections, and we're going to talk about some of that and how they fared in this arena in the recent election. But before we get to specifics, just give me the broad 30,000-foot overview here, the broad stroke impression of the progress being made or not being made by women in politics, Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to give a little recent history, we had seen obviously monumental and historic gains after the 2016 election in both 2018 and again in 2020, with record numbers of women running for office, winning, ultimately serving. And there were some differences in party, but ultimately we were seeing those steady gains at a higher rate than we had seen previously. And that was across levels of office. That slowed a bit in 2022. And then in 2024, again, we saw women not reach those record levels as it pertains to candidacy. And then ultimately, in the results of the election, as a quick summary, we'll see a slight decline in the number of women in Congress by one. We will see a record number of women governors, but again, by one. And we will see a slight increase in state legislatures nationally, though, as you noted, those are different state by state. And also, it's the smallest net gain we have seen in the last four cycles.
I don't want to spend a lot of time doing a postmortem on this last election, but I want to spend just a second on it. The two women who have run unsuccessfully for president, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, both ran and were defeated, ran against and were defeated by Donald Trump. Clinton won the popular vote that year, but not the Electoral College. Harris is just a shade away from winning the popular vote. I think she's like 1.68% below Donald Trump, but he once again took the Electoral College. And in both elections, Donald Trump portrayed himself as a strong man leader, willing to trash the norms and do things differently. And he really appealed this time around to young male voters, the so-called bro culture. Some say that both Clinton and Harris had inadequacies as candidates that led to their downfall. Others say that women did not support either of them to the degree that was anticipated. What I don't know that any of those answers are right, but what, if anything, Kelly, can we glean from these two contests and the failure of these two candidates to win the presidency?
Yeah, so I think we have to be really careful in kind of blaming the fact that they were women as the reason that they lost these races. I think, as you've pointed to, Donald Trump has engaged in strategies that are very much focused on not just masculinism, right? Not just proving that masculine equals presidential and therefore, these women don't fit that presidential model. He literally said Hillary Clinton doesn't have the presidential look. So he did leverage that contrast in gender in ways that could potentially advantage him against women candidates. But more than that, he does the same against men. And so what he was really tapping into, we know this from research, we saw it again in 2024, was both sexism and racism in the electorate that allowed the type of rhetoric and behavior and policy priorities that he put forward as being not disqualifying and as actually rallying some support to his side. And I think that would have happened, in my view, unfortunately, whether or not the candidate had been Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. So I think we have to be able to look at the ways in which Clinton and Harris were targeted and treated in different ways, the ways in which their qualifications, as you noted, were scrutinized in ways different than male counterparts and arguably unfairly. But at the same time, realize that their gender and race were only part of the puzzle to understanding why they ultimately lost. And so it would be a real shame, and I think wrong, to suggest that women couldn't win in the future or that the country is somehow not ready. As you noted, Hillary Clinton won the majority of votes, and we know that women have outpaced and succeeded men in all of our recent elections in some of the most competitive races. So women can win. I believe they can win at the highest levels, but we also have to grapple with the fact that there are a lot of voters in this country who are unwilling to disqualify a candidate for that level of misogyny and racism.
Aaron, you run this organization called She Should Run. And at some point in the summer, when President Biden decided not to run for re-election, somebody somewhere in the Democratic Party said, you know, she should run, she being Kamala Harris. Did the shortness of her campaign, because it was just over 100 days, and he's been running since, well, since the first election, he never stopped running, was the shortness of her campaign, which led to a very close popular vote total, mean that women are considered viable presidential candidates? She did pretty well, despite the fact that she joined the race late. Have the candidacies of Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris removed any reluctance by political parties going forward to nominate a woman as their standard bearer?
My hope is absolutely yes. Look, w women, as Kelly pointed out, women have proven that they can win races. They win races at the same rate as men. I think this was a really special and unusual circumstance. And the shortness of the race, you could point to a number of factors here, but ultimately, she ran a really incredible race for the amount of time that she was in it. And if anything, every woman that steps up and runs at a higher level builds the pathway for the next woman to be able to do the same. And the races of Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris may have looked very differently, but you could most definitely look back in time and say, okay, we've gained as a society an ability to sort of normalize this, to normalize women in positions of leadership. The more we do that, the more it makes it possible for the next woman behind.
Brad, you work as executive director of the North Carolina Institute of Political Leadership with both men and women who aspire to political office and other positions of leadership. And Kelly mentioned a second ago that perhaps Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton, well, not perhaps, definitely, were scrutinized differently than male candidates might have been. Is that true up and down the chain from local races to the presidency, or is it predominantly something that occurs in these presidential contests, Brad?
Well, I certainly think that there are heightened amounts of scrutiny that are put onto candidates at the national level that you might not see at a local level. They're getting into personality profiles and whether someone worked at McDonald's 20, 30 years ago, and not just maybe their record, their voting record in a chamber, say if someone's running for county commission after a time on a school board or something along those lines. So there is that scrutiny. But I think people are looking for qualified candidates, and certainly when we're talking about a local or state level, I think that there is perhaps some, but not obviously not nearly as much as what we see at a national level.
What I'm hearing from you, and perhaps even from Kelly, is that misogyny still works, at least at the presidential level, at least in terms of putting doubt in the minds of voters, making them hesitant about pulling the lever for a female candidate. How long can this continue, Brad? I mean, and will it be helped by more women entering at lower levels of office?
Certainly. I mean, I think building the pipeline is the only real solution to the problem. But as Kelly said, with the national elections, it's very easy to be monocausal about all of these things, that there's one reason that this happened, but there's so many factors that it's very difficult to condense everything down to just gender, particularly for a presidential race. Where in 2016, we're talking about Hillary Clinton trying to hold on to a White House after the Democrats have already held it for 8 years. And then that's very difficult for a party to do. You mentioned the 100 days that Vice President Harris had to face in this particular election. So small sample size. Obviously, we have a good number of male candidates that we can make a little bit more judgments off of facial hair and all these other categories that you might use. But small sample size. But that's continuing to grow. We're seeing this as more and more of a theme in presidential politics. And we're starting to see, we're starting to see more females, as candidates and also as cabinet secretaries. And I think it's a matter of time. I don't know when that'll be, but I don't think people would be less likely to vote for a female candidate in the future.
Kelly?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in here. A couple years ago, I was doing an interview with a staffer who had worked for Stacey Abrams running for governor. And one of the things a phrase she used was, we had to run a concurrent campaign of belief. And I, to this day, find that super helpful for us to understand how gender and race can act as hurdles to women running for office, but not ultimately as a barrier or determinative barrier, right? So they had to prove to voters, donors, practitioners, et cetera, they had to make a case that a Black woman could win a governorship, which, by the way, no Black woman has ever done in our country. And so they had to make this case while simultaneously running a traditional campaign. Here's why I'm the best candidate. Here's why I have the best policies for this state, et cetera, et cetera. And so that to me gets at, it's not so much that when folks go to the ballot box, they won't vote for a woman, right? But it is all the questions about, is she electable? Can she do it? Is she going to face different scrutiny and therefore we shouldn't put her in the office, right? So it's not always even emerging from an overt misogyny. But these doubts, as you mentioned, are part of the challenge that makes the candidacy at least different and often just more expensive in terms of the labor that women have to do in order to prove that they can win and be successful.
And Brad brought up something that I have not heard really mentioned very often, if at all, about in a postmortem sense, that Hillary Clinton was trying to be president after 8 years of a Democratic presidency. And it's really difficult to move beyond 8 years for any political party. And then you have Kamala Harris coming along, who, no matter who the nominee was going to be for the Democrats, whether it was going to be Joe Biden or somebody else, another guy, Biden's approval rating was incredibly low, and people had really negative opinions of the economy. No matter what the economy was actually doing, they weren't feeling it, and that's how they voted. And I'm not sure anybody could have overcome that. When we come back, we'll talk about gender being an obstacle, why it's an obstacle, and how much longer that can possibly last in this country when other countries have already gone well beyond it. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about women in politics, their success, their lack of success, the nudging along the way, the climbing of the hill, and whether that's something that can continue and why shouldn't it. Kelly Dittmar is with us. She's an associate professor of political science at Rutgers Camden and director of research at the Center for American Women in Politics. Erin Los Cotraro is founder and CEO of She Should Run, and Brad Young is executive director of the North Carolina Institute of Political Leadership. Erin, Gerald Ford once predicted that America would get its first female president only when a male incumbent could no longer continue. I think that was disproven this time around, but given what happened in 2016 and 2024, is he right, or have inroads been made by these two unsuccessful runs for president?
Undoubtedly, inroads have been made. Like I said before, when women step up and lead, it changes the game for women who step up behind them. You know, the barriers that women face when they run are real. You know, they range from cultural barriers to systemic barriers to, you know, to social barriers. But every time we see additional women step into, and frankly, this is across all roles of leadership, it makes that inevitability sort of, we tick away at it a little bit so that the next woman behind can see, okay, there's a pathway. And you know, I think it's important to point out in these cases too that women aren't monolithic. So the more women we have stepping up, the more that we can see that, you know, there's diverse perspectives and experiences across the board, and you know, to celebrate that and build those pathways is important.
Brad, the reality is it's only been a little over 100 years that women had the right to vote in this country. They still have not passed the Equal Rights Amendment in this country. But women have been running things since the beginning of time. I mean, they have run households, they've run family farms, they've moved on to running civic boards and organizations like PTAs. Are the leadership qualities, because you work with people of both genders moving into leadership positions, are the leadership qualities used in those positions really any different from those required for political leadership?
I don't necessarily believe so. I think there's some universal elements of those political skills that we maybe don't recognize on a regular basis. I think ambition might be the bigger separator when we talk about the ambition gap that you encounter with female candidates or potential candidates for elected office. You know, studies have shown that as young as 6 years old, girls are more interested in politics and government, and over the time of them growing up and becoming actually eligible to run for those offices, that interest decreases. And that could be attributable to internalizing gender roles or whatever you might attribute that to, but there is a general interest to that, and those skills of building consensus and getting things done. Time and time again, we've seen female legislators in state houses across the state, the country, excuse me, that are more productive, that do get things done, and certainly those skills that we see in the boardroom, as you mentioned, some of the community level organization, certainly could benefit our government, and that's one of the reasons that our organization focuses on training in that particular population.
You used two words, Brad, that I find interesting: recognition, as we realize and recognize that women can do these jobs. Maybe that changes your mind in the voting booth at some point in time. It certainly has at lower levels. Maybe someday it will do so at the presidential level. And the other is ambition. This is a sticky wicket for women. Erin and Kelly, I'd like to get your perspective on this, because when a woman is ambitious, when she takes the reins, when she knows what she wants and is going to get it, if she were a man, he would be strong and powerful and something to be emulated. When a woman does it, just ask Barbara Streisand, she's the B word. How difficult does that make political candidacy at the highest levels for women? And I will start with you, Erin.
Yeah, happy to jump in on it. You know, I always like when I'm thinking about ambition, certainly in the political arena, I actually first think about this reality, and Brad alluded to it, that there is a there's a real ambition gap. So before we can even get to the point that women are held to a higher standard, and there's certainly a double standard out there in what our leadership looks like in all of the rooms, you know, women are less likely to see themselves as qualified. They're less likely to be recruited for office. And at She Should Run, this is really the premise of, you know, our entire work is how do we get to the women who aren't already thinking about running for office? And, you know, much of the sort of political recruitment and candidate recruitment that's happened over time has focused on women who already sort of have that ambition, right? Who sort of, and there are some, and they're incredible. They start thinking about running for office when they're in kindergarten and they don't stop, and we need to support that. But the reality is the vast majority of women aren't thinking about it because they're not being encouraged to run for office. And certainly when they look at the highest level, they're not seeing themselves represented. And so for us, you know, we're laser focused on how do we get to those women who are, you know, leading in the workplace, leading in their communities, leading in their homes, who have incredible value to bring to elected office. And the only way we can do that is to, you know, show up where they already are, to, you know, connect the dots between the ways that they're already leading with what they could accomplish for their communities. And when you turn that light bulb on, then it's pretty unstoppable. And we need to encourage more of it because there are a lot of women sitting on the sidelines that we need. In the conversation.
Kelly, let me get your take on this, because if you are going to be at the highest level of any organization, whether it's a company or whether it's president of the United States, you have to have almost ruthless ambition to make it in that world and to survive in that world. And if you don't have the ambition to get there, you're not going to get there. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have debates in this literature about what we actually mean by ambition and how we measure it. So I would argue that, yes, there is an ambition gap if you ask the question, do you want to run for office? Mm-hmm. But there's not a gap when you ask women about them wanting to make a difference, right? So if you are thinking more broadly about this question, what we really are finding is women are seeing other ways to make a difference. And by the way, they're looking at the institutions as they are and saying, these are not friendly to me. In fact, they are toxic. I mean, look at Sarah McBride gets into Congress and then they tell her she cannot use the bathroom, right? Like we are in an environment where there are these are workplaces that have not been particularly friendly to women. Campaigns have presented distinct challenges. So I would suggest we, you know, think about the reasons why women may say they don't want to run are not just a lack of confidence or they have no interest, right? It's because they see the structural barriers, they see the social political barriers. And so we have to address those so that the work is, yes, absolutely encouraging as Aaron's organization and our organization does, but we also have to think about simultaneously, and I know we're doing this, how are we tackling those broader barriers that make it so that women look to other places to make a difference?
But Brad, you work with both genders in getting people involved in leadership positions, not just in politics, but in organizations. And the whole world has been a boys' club for millennia. So the problems that you face in politics probably are not unlike those in any other endeavor. What do you tell women? How they come to you, I would think, so they're already primed to want to take these positions. But what do you tell women who are not primed, but who would be great at it if they were?
Certainly. And in addition to our fellows program, which is that we serve both men and women that are thinking about getting involved in public leadership in some capacity. We also have a Women on Board program, and we've hosted Ready to Run programming from Kelly's organization, the Center for American Women in Politics. And that is Women on Board. When we talk about board, we're talking about boards and commissions. And that's a great place for women to get started because it is a particular, not just women, anybody. I recommend everyone be on boards and commissions before they run for elected office of any sort, because it allows you to focus on the areas where your passions are. It allows you to learn the inner workings of government. We see 61% of women that do run for office or are in elected office, started in boards and commissions. So it's understanding the system, understanding the work that's being done, and also showing them and showing other participants on these boards how their passion can translate to meaningful change. So whether that's arts council, to what we're talking about with when we say power boards with planning and zoning boards. So it's a great place to start to build those skills, that confidence, that network that is essential for anyone that wants to get involved in politics. And it's just that it's a great first step, and that's why we encourage women in particular to seek out those opportunities in their community.
How do you prep women for this, Aaron? I mean, go ahead. You wanted to comment on what Brad just said, but how do you prep women
Yeah,
for
because I
this?
think it's a really important point is, lots of people think that running for office sort of starts with when your name's on the ballot, and the reality is that it starts with you getting involved in your local community. And we see at She Should Run, this in the case making, which by the way has become increasingly more difficult to make because of how toxic politics is. The case making has to start in a place of, okay, if you get more dialed in to what's happening in your local community, you see the difference you can make. And then that idea of how you can disrupt the system that is pretty awful, for women and for people of color to serve in, the only way to disrupt that is to be in it and make the change from within. And so to start doing that, you have to take the steps in your local community. And we see largely, I mean, overwhelmingly, that when women make the decision to engage in their local communities, that they continue forward with the next leadership role, the next leadership role. So it absolutely is the place to start.
I don't know which one of you to ask this question, but we just witnessed a campaign in which toxic masculinity was front and center in the bright white spotlight and eventually won out. Would things be any different? Of course, there would be an absence of toxic masculinity, but would politics be less toxic if there were more women in the field? I don't know who to ask that of. Kelly, go ahead.
I mean, yeah, I'm happy to look. Obviously, our organization is advocating for, having more women in positions of political power. And as Erin said, a diversity of women. We know that women have diverse points of view, lived experiences, et cetera. I think that historically, we can make a pretty strong claim that when women are in office, they are more focused on getting things done. Part of that is because of the barriers they faced along the way, right? They're doing a cost benefit. Is it worth it? Well, it's only worth it if I get things done, right? So historically, we have seen women be more willing to compromise and kind of create conditions that allow for more things to get done. As we've seen greater polarization, it streamlines and kind of narrows which women are able to get in and also kind of polices their behavior in a way that I think prevents us from making that broader claim that there's a gender difference in the willingness to engage in at least hyper-partisanship. I think toxicity takes it to another level. I always worry that we try to make a case that women are somehow better to prove that they should be in office, when in fact, men don't have to make that case that they're better. So we should be making a case based on representativeness. Women should have the ability to have the same range of representational approach and perspective as do their male counterparts. Sometimes that means we get women in office who contribute to the toxicity. But if we get more women in those spaces, we hope that for everybody, that democratic dialogue and an overall reduction of toxicity will help.
If you plot the number of women in political positions on a graph, the graph is going up. If you zoom in tight, you'll see it going up and down and up and down like a roller coaster, which is how most things in the world operate if they're on an upward curve. It's not always up. There are moments when you have downs. In this last election, it resulted in a reduction in the number of women, for instance, serving in the South Carolina legislature. And in our state, women will make up less than a third of the legislature in the next session. But gains out west mean that the next sessions of the Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada legislatures will have female majorities. Kelly, why? Is there something going on out west that is more open to this? I mean, did it have to do with the quality of the candidates or the quality of the campaigns or the issues and the women who won their responses to those issues? What was at play here?
Yeah, as usual, I don't want to simplify kind of regional differences down to, why this is the case. I'm sure there are a lot of specific reasons within the political ecosystems of each of these states that help to account for this. I will say it's fair to look at the history of representation and see that women have fared better in Western states, and they have fared particularly worse in Southern states in the United States. There is a cultural piece of this that's kind of undeniable, right? If we look at the history of simply, transitions out to the West and the division of private and public spheres for men and women, there was just has always been more of a culture of integration for women in the West. Not to say that there isn't sexism, not to say that there aren't those same barriers, but in both the South and the Northeast, we saw more explicit divisions of private and public sphere. In the South, more adherence to religious values of traditional gender roles that can also be prohibitive or have been prohibitive. And then finally, in the current politics, I would argue it's party. So in states where Democrats do well, women do well. Women are much better represented. They're about at parity with men in the Democratic candidate pool and in many states' Democratic caucuses. Among Republicans, they are less than usually about 20% of candidates, less than about 20 or 25% of office holders. And so in states where Republicans are doing well, that doesn't tend to fare well for women, at least in the current political dynamic.
Brad.
And just to build on what Kelly is saying, you do have to look at it at a state by state basis, particularly in North Carolina. You have to ask the larger question of who can really afford to serve in our legislature. It's a full-time job. You add on another full-time job campaigning for it and fundraising for it. And then the job itself pays $14,000 a year. So you might have someone that would be in position to serve in Wake County, which there's a minimal commute to work. But people in the western part of the state or the far eastern parts of the state that might struggle to participate in the same way. So it's a question of not only can you afford to run, but can you afford to win? Those are things that all candidates in the legislative level and every level of government have to weigh.
So, Brad, I have less than 30 seconds. It just occurred to me as you were talking that women who are coming from ground zero may not have the kinds of financial connections and interconnectedness that men do. Is that a problem for fundraising? I have 20 seconds.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's something that that with more women in office can support other women to continue to fundraise, and an issue that will continue to change and evolve over the course of the next few elections.
When we come back, I want to explore a little bit this West-South divide when it comes to women in politics. We'll do that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. Listener-funded, our listeners have made this program possible today through their financial support, and we thank you. Kelly Dittmar is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University Camden, Director of Research at the Center for American Women in Politics. Erin Loos-Cotraro is Founder and CEO of She Should Run. Brad Young is Executive Director of the North Carolina Institute of Political Leadership. Both of those last two organizations work carefully with bringing women and men into leadership positions. Brad, because our legislature, the North Carolina legislature, will be and has been in recent years about 70% male, I was going to ask if this is because we are a southern state and the barriers here are more difficult, which kind of came up in the comparison to what's going on in the west of America. But Bev Perdue was our governor not so long ago. And in South Carolina, where female representation is down in the legislature, Nikki Haley was governor not too long ago. Kay Ivey is the governor of Alabama. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, both Republicans, by the way, is the governor of Arkansas. So is it a southern thing? These diminutive numbers of females in the legislature, but they're governors?
I would defer to Kelly as far as looking at the nation on a whole. But, what we had talked about earlier about women that do get into the legislature might only be 30%, as we talked about. We're starting to see women get into more leadership roles within the legislature in North Carolina. Just yesterday, or I guess earlier this week, I'll say, Sidney Batch became the Senate Minority Leader. We had Kathy Harrington after tw the 2020 election became the Senate Majority Leader on the Republican side. Sarah Stevens was a Speaker Pro Tem in the House. So while the number is fluctuating, it goes up and down a little bit every election. The trend line is going up, but it is still having a struggle of breaking that 35% representation line in North Carolina's General Assembly. But we are seeing more women in leadership when they do get to Raleigh.
Well, how, Kelly, since you have this 30,000 foot view of all this, how do women get to be governors of southern states when their representation in the legislatures are not representative of their numbers in the population?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it does, when women are in the state legislature or in any local offices, it helps to build the pipeline for those higher level offices, but that's not always the only route to get there. Also, when you're talking about gubernatorial offices, there's a double edge on this, right? You have that the fact that there's only this office, and so it can make it that much harder for anybody, let alone a woman, to get into it. At the same point, in a state like you mentioned Alabama, so more so than North Carolina, Alabama or even South Carolina, a Republican is going to win that office, right? So if we were to have a woman to get into that gubernatorial seat, it's most likely going to be a woman. And that is not at all to discount Nikki Haley or Kay Ivey. But I think we have to understand as well the kind of interaction of the party dynamics that means that, yes, absolutely, women can still achieve this success. But it has often taken longer and been a bit harder for them to get there because that pipeline, that pool of Republican women, it hasn't been as large. And the efforts of the Republican Party have been different, right? So when we did work in five different states, our southern state, if you count it that way, is Oklahoma in our case study in Georgia. And we were looking at what were the differences to get women in office. And one of the biggest takeaways that we put out last winter in our report called Rethinking Women's Political Power was that Republicans we interviewed, over 200 people, of the Republicans we interviewed, they were much more likely not to see women's political underrepresentation as a problem in need of targeted solutions. They were much more averse to our Ready to Run program or other targeted programs that focused only on women. And so that's a bigger philosophical difference between
Is
the
that
parties that doesn't make them bad. It makes it harder to level the playing field.
does that play into the argument that Democrats are too identity politics focused? One part of your identity is your gender, of course, and Republicans don't care about that. They just want the candidate, whoever that person is.
That's their argument. But if you look at the campaigns, they're absolutely using identity politics, right? Donald Trump is absolutely using identity politics. It's just about whiteness and maleness and masculinity, right? Or anti-immigrant or anti-trans, right? So identity politics, depending on how we define it, are absolutely being kind of used, if you will, or focused on by anybody who's in politics. But I think what you're speaking to, and what certainly we heard, was we don't want to make any targeted efforts to support candidates based on demographics. I would argue to you, and I think my co-panelists probably agree on this point, that demographic identity is not what we're getting at when we say we want more women to want run. We're getting at a distinct lived experience and perspective that helps in our democratic debates and dialogue.
Erin certainly agrees with you because she wants to talk about this. Go ahead.
I couldn't agree more. Look, I think that a really important piece of this is this reality that it gets back to the why do we want more women in an office point. And we want more women in office because women are 51% of the population. And without true representation, we are missing out as a country. We're missing out on talent and perspective and opportunity. And so while those strategies most definitely need to look differently regionally and need to acknowledge and embrace cultural differences and preferences, we cannot deny that there is this major missed opportunity when we're not building targeted strategies that open pathways for women from all walks of life.
Let's expand on that, because we've been talking about the numbers of women in politics going up and down, but we haven't talked really a lot about why. Who cares? Why should we care whether they're there or not? And Paul Hyde, who has written an article in the South Carolina Gazette, agrees with you, Aaron. He says the problem with the South Carolina legislature is women. There aren't enough of them. The House and Senate, he says, are largely boys' clubs and have been for a long time. They are laughably unrepresentative of the state. And more importantly, he says, the women bring distinct perspectives and life experiences to the table. And as has been said on this program already, they get things done. Kelly, in addition to being director of research at the Center for American Women in Politics, you also co-authored the book, A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Representation Matters. So share some of their thoughts on that topic.
Yeah, to exactly this point, when we talk about why representation matters, we're often talking about, I think as Aaron alluded to, there's a fairness and justice reason. We're supposed to be a representative democracy, and so we should be representative of the constituencies we serve. But when we get to the substantive piece, which is what sells people, right? Like what difference are they making in policy? Again, it's not one universal thing. When we asked women in Congress, you know, what difference do you make? They didn't say, oh, we passed childcare bills, right? Like it wasn't one thing, but it was in many policy debates, often the most important policy debates on economics, on welfare reform, on healthcare reform, women were bringing perspectives to the table that their male counterparts did not have. So we can give like the most explicit examples, right? So you look in the 1990s, women in Congress were the ones that made sure that women were actually in studies being done by the NIH to ensure that medical trials were actually going to serve women in a way that they could be safe with the outcomes of medications and procedures. Later, women were responsible in armed services for pushing the boundaries on addressing sexual assault in the military. It wasn't until we had multiple women on the Armed Services Committee, Republicans and Democrats, who said, wait a second, we're just like, we're not paying attention to this issue that, by the way, affects men and women. But women understood really innately that this is a problem, not just in the military, but writ large. It was also women who sponsored legislation to make sure that armor in the military actually fit women's bodies, right? So in so many of these cases, you hear women say things like, the men aren't intentionally leaving us out of the conversation, but they may not understand and have the experiences that make them think about the right questions to ask and voices to bring to the table that change both the agenda and the outcomes.
And that plays into something that political scientist Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University has made. He's been on this program many times, Kelly, because he's local and he's terrific. But he points out, he made this point in post-election comments about the North Carolina General Assembly. He said that if in the General Assembly, these people, these men, were a single voting bloc, men would have a supermajority control of that body. And this is the case in all legislative bodies, except those we mentioned out west, about 11 or 12 or 7 or 8, I don't know the number of legislatures where women are in the majority, and certainly in the Congress it is true. Are women's voices being effectively squelched, and worse, are they being mansplained to? Who would like to take that?
Me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I would like to. No, sorry.
There you go.
What Kelly means.
I'll go. I'll be brief because I'm sure Aaron will have something to say here too. I think that there is an aspect of yes, their voices are at least being outnumbered, but I think what Brad has pointed to earlier is important. Numbers don't always equal power. So when we have women who are in leadership of their party, the head of committees, even if their numbers are small, they can have a huge influence. So I don't want to discount the fact that when women are 20 and 30%, they can make a significant difference. It would help if there were more of them. And it would probably make it even more likely that they're in those leadership spaces. But you know, it doesn't discount their power. And one other thing, the party caucuses again, right? So if it may be that you're 20% of the legislature, but you're 50% of your caucus, that matters too, because as we know, in a two-party system, party caucuses can have a significant influence on shaping agendas and votes.
Aaron, do you want to comment on that? Oh, Brad does. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, and just as a general concept of good government, you want a legitimate government is a representative government. And if 50% of our population is female, it only makes sense to have 50% of our legislative and governing bodies be female as a goal to aspire to. And we've talked about, you know, women not being a monolith as far as being a voter block. We looked at this most recent election, and we're starting to see a gap growing between single women and married women. So they're representing different issues, and looking at, you know, all of our politics and our policy, it's so large and so vast that that different women at different stages with different experiences of their life are approaching these things differently. And that's another reason that it's important to have a larger number represented in our government.
But Aaron, as you mentioned earlier, women are not a monolith. No group is monolith. But in order to get 50% or 51% of the legislators in this country to be women, to reflect the reality of the population, the women running for those offices have to want them. And more importantly, the voters, the women voters, have to want them, do they?
They do. Absolutely. They do. And here's the reality. They haven't had the opportunity to make that choice up and down the ticket. So in our work, I'm regularly asked as a leader of an organization that helps women run for office is, you know, am I making the case that everybody should vote for every woman on the ballot? And I always say, look, here's what I'm making the case for. I'm making the case that when you step into the ballot box or you vote however you vote, that you have the opportunity to have a ballot that is fully representative of the population. We are all better served when that happens. So it isn't about one woman or how we can, you know, make the case that every single woman should represent one thing. They won't. We should be making the case that the ballots represent the people, period.
I only have a couple minutes left. I want to touch on something that is really kind of peripheral to this discussion, but maybe not. A lot of voters, Brad, see politics and politicians as being corrupt. And your organization is founded by a group of North Carolinians who were concerned about the lack of integrity found in our political system in the state. That was back in the mid-70s. It could be argued that things are actually worse today. So are you fighting a losing battle, and would having more women in higher ranking political positions change the equation, or once kissed by power, would they succumb to the same temptations?
Oh, that's a huge question. where do you even begin with that? So, going back to the beginning of what you said, our organization was founded post-Watergate in the mid-70s, and things have changed. We've produced over 1,200 local community leaders over that time. Many of them served in elected office. And, you know, that's how you make a change. We have a state that is rapidly growing. The issues that North Carolinians care about is changing with the population changing here. So we want to make sure that we're producing leaders that are reflective of that, and make sure that we are creating something that produces leaders that have integrity, that value inclusivity and understanding across the aisle. That's the bipartisan nature of what we do. But You know, that's one of the hardest things that we could talk about. You can't expect women to step in and be some kind of savior of our politics, because that's just not what people are. You know, human nature includes women just as much as it includes men. But like I've said before, with some of just the impact of once they get in office, the ability to change and shape policy, to create understanding that we see, in, whether it's corporate boards or whether they're limited involvement that we're seeing in public involvement, then that's something that we at least have to try, because that's what I think our government should aspire to.
And one aspect of corruption in politics has to do with the money in politics, the money needed to run for office. And your organization, Kelly, reports that men outstrip women in making political contributions. Were those men giving to both male and female candidates, or mostly males giving to males, females giving to females?
Yeah, my colleague Kirsten Amatsu has done really important work on the gender gap in donors and women money in politics. And I would just say, so it's not that men are only giving to men, but we do see a slight preference that women donors are often more likely to give to women candidates. And so when you add to the fact that then women are actually giving less overall than their male counterparts, so in the current election, about 30% of donations, we want more women to give, and it should benefit women candidates.
Since all three of you are working to get more women involved, very quickly, yes or no, are you optimistic about the future, yes or no, Kelly?
Yes.
Brad?
Absolutely.
Aaron?
100%.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Aaron Los Cotraro with She Should Run, Brad Young with the North Carolina Institute for Political Leadership, and Kelly Dittmar with Rutgers.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.